this event from the Lowy Institute's Australia Papua New Guinea Network. My name's Anne-Marie O'Keefe, and I'm a non-resident fellow here at the Institute. Except, of course, today we're not at the Institute because of the social distancing requirements of COVID. But I'd like to begin by acknowledging the Yuin people who are the traditional custodians of the land on which I am speaking today, which is not Sydney, it's the far south coast of New South Wales. And I'd like to pay my respects to the Yuin elders past and present of this beautiful part of Australia. I'd also like to thank the sponsors of the Australia PNG Network Events Program for 2020. That's the Bank of South Pacific, or BSP, as most of us know it by, and Coca-Cola Amatil. The Institute also appreciates very much the support of the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade for the Australia PNG Network Project. Very happy that you could join us today. And we're going to be talking about the strange times in which both our countries find ourselves, along with the rest of the world. PNG and Australia, like the rest of the world, are facing an extraordinary time as we tackle COVID-19. Here in Australia, we are now behind a closed border with few exemptions. PNG has implemented strict requirements for anyone wanting to enter. And while only a handful of kilometres separate our two countries, we don't know when we might be able to resume the sort of economic, diplomatic, family, tourism, all the sorts of interactions we had and just took for granted only 6 months ago. Fortunately, both Australia and PNG have suffered significantly less than almost anywhere else in the world. But it's not over. And here in Australia, we are dealing with flare-ups, while in PNG, it's steady as she goes, but for now. How's this shared crisis affected our bilateral relationship? We're going to look ahead today and see what lessons might have come out of COVID for our shared future. What should our bilateral priorities be? And to talk about this, I'm very pleased to welcome two very experienced hands in the PNG-Australia relationship. First, I'd like to introduce Sir Charles Lapani, who served as PNG's High Commissioner to Australia from 2005 to 2017. He's also one of the original Gang of Four who helped establish the administration of the newly independent PNG nation. Also with us is Ian Kemish, former High Commissioner to Port Moresby and former Ambassador to Germany, as well as International Advisor to the Prime Minister. Ian is now an advisor with Newcrest Mining and the Bao Group Asia, and also, like me, a non-resident fellow at the Lowy Institute. Welcome, Ian. And welcome, Sir Charles.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Before we start, just a bit of housekeeping. I'll lead the discussion. Actually, I'll be putting some tricky questions to Ian and John until about 11:30, and then we'll be opening the floor to questions from our audience. We'll be using the Zoom Q&A function to do this. So press the button on your screen and type the question you'd like us to answer. So to get our discussion started, I'd like to sort of take a broad view of how things are going with the bilateral relationship between our two countries. And it's coincidental, but probably fortunate, that both governments are in the process of negotiating a new bilateral agreement, namely a comprehensive strategic and economic partnership. And that's to boost engagement across a range of issues, including security cooperation, trade, investment, regional development, etc. So to open up, I'd like to ask Sir Charles, first, if you don't mind, what do you see as the priorities that such a strategic partnership should be looking at? What can we draw from the COVID experience that should influence the way in which we move forward?
I think the important area of focus could be realigning Australia's aid to supporting trade and investment and economic focus for both countries. While aid has played historically a very important part of Papua New Guinea's development and our partnership, I think to realign Australia's aid to supporting initiatives towards, for instance, a trilateral arrangement of an economic zone between Indonesia, Australia, and Papua New Guinea to start off with. At the moment, there's a focus for a sub-regional arrangement in PESA Plus. I think Papua New Guinea has not been fully on board with that for a while. I'm not sure whether they have come around, but it is, we have come around, but it is a contentious area for Papua New Guinea. So my suggestion is we focus on a sub-region of APEC regional organization, which is Indonesia, Papua New Guinea, and Australia, and of course New Zealand could be in there. Market size would be viable. Australia has established the North Australia Development Project with a funding of around $500 million. That needs to be progressed because that would provide a good linkage for Papua New Guinea and Indonesia to enter activities in the marketplace for whatever development that might arise from that. So I think essentially while the Development Assistance Program on aid has been the backbone of our bilateral relations, I think to start refocusing because with the pandemic, there are views that globalization may falter going forward. So sub-regional arrangements may be the first step to reconstruct and align our economic activities and arrangements and partnerships here. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Sir Charles. Ian, what views do you have on this?
Look, the first thing I would say is that I believe that the cooperation between Australia and Papua New Guinea through the pandemic so far has actually been very positive, very practical. It hasn't just been about support for the PNG system. There's been a genuine exchange of information between the two governments. You know, our experience together has been, in the circumstances, it's been okay. I mean, PNG benefits from the fact that Australia has, notwithstanding the issues in Victoria, been relatively successful itself in managing the pandemic so far. But I must say, I think PNG's management of the situation has been commendable. As we move forward, going to the core of your question, as we move forward and think about the relationship through this and post the crisis, yes, we should be thinking in a immediate way about what this teaches us about the importance of cooperation in the health sector. But beyond that, we're going to need a joint regional plan with genuine regional ownership when it comes to economic recovery for the Pacific. And I think Australia and Papua New Guinea will need to work very closely in that sense. As Sir Charles has said, there are existing arrangements, APEC was scoped there with PESA Plus to provide a vehicle for that that recovery plan. But look, when it comes to the economic and strategic relationship, I very much trust that it will be genuinely strategic. You mentioned in introducing me that I'd also been ambassador in Germany, and you reminded me of a point. When we when I sat in Berlin representing one developed economy to another very major developed economy, when we thought about the bilateral relationship, it wasn't just about the point-to-point relationship. It was what we could do together elsewhere. In the German case, it was what Australia and Germany could do in places like Afghanistan or in joined up work in the region. That's a genuinely strategic relationship. And it's that kind of mindset that I think needs to be brought to the relationship between Australia and PNG. There is scope in the region for us to work together on common interests that aren't necessarily about that point-to-point relationship. PNG has exercised some influence in the region in the past. You think about the Ramsey contribution in Solomon Islands. When I was High Commissioner, PNG had a couple of people with UN deployments in Sudan. There is something in that, and I think it should start in the region. And to me, it's logical that it should start with an economic recovery plan for the region.
Good. Well, staying with you, Ian, I wanted to move on to geostrategic competition in the region and particularly how it affects the bilateral relationship. As we know, the Pacific Step Up is one of Australia's highest foreign policy priorities. And while the Australian government insists that the Step Up responds to broad-ranging challenges of our region, and there's no doubt that that's true, challenges such as climate change, disaster resilience, economic growth, which, as you've just mentioned, perhaps the need to have a joint regional plan for economic recovery. But it's also been seen by quite a range of commentators and observers, including here at the Lowy Institute, that it's seen as Australia's response to what it sees as a growing geostrategic competition in the region, particularly from China. Within the PNG context, this has played out in a number of ways. We saw that in what I called the bidding competition in the lead up to APEC between Australia and China, supporting PNG and its ability to host APEC. And we've seen it more recently with Australia's investment in the Coral Sea Cable. How healthy, Ian, is this competition for Australia's relationship with PNG?
Look, as somebody who, like Charles, has been a very strong believer in the bilateral relationship and a very strong believer in the importance of Canberra really focusing on Papua New Guinea, I strongly welcome the Step Up engagement. I think it's real. I think it's genuine. I think it's taken practical form. The motivations, people can speculate about that, but I prefer to think of it very much as reflecting an assessment of the importance of the region. If there's some motivation associated with other players, then fine by me. But I think let's take it on its merits. I also think Papua New Guinea is entirely entitled to diversify its own external links. I think that it's inevitable that a growing China will look at investing more strategically and economically in places like Papua New Guinea, given its wealth of resources. Interesting thing is not much has actually eventuated in the China-PNG relationship since all the hoopla of APEC 2018, in my view. There hasn't been that much to it. The China relationship has been held up on many occasions in the past as the next big thing. You know, we all remember the look north policies of previous administrations. To me, it's not a zero-sum game. Australia needs to work positively with China in Papua New Guinea. I mean, Australia has its own bilateral imperatives in Beijing. There's some precedent for trilateral cooperation. There's been a solid program in anti-malaria work in the past. And I think if Australians are true friends of Papua New Guinea, and we are, we'll find a positive way to engage China there. I think in PNG, Charles should say, but, you know, I think while there's an opportunity to play one off against the other, there's really very little interest in PNG in my estimation, in getting rolled up in a major geostrategic competition there. As for China, you know, why would it want to work with us in PNG? Well, I do think it will at some point need to reevaluate its own aggressive diplomacy at a global level. It's experiencing tensions right across the world right now. And its own experience with investment in PNG has not always been an entirely happy one. So, you know, I think there's plenty of reasons for all of us to work together in a trilateral way.
So, Charles?
Yes, I do endorse Ian's comments that Papua New Guinea is, of course, a sovereign nation. It decides who it will partner with in terms of development. But it does bring to focus the potential for strategic security concerns that may flow onto Papua New Guinea. We have maintained a very neutral position on this question from China and Australia, because we are friends to both of you. There is the offer of the project that has really to be substantially moved forward, and that is the energy project that was to be funded by jointly by Australia, PNG, US, and Japan. That's still to be implemented. That was offered during APEC, and that was seen as a countermeasure to China, these activities in the region. So in the end, as Ian said, both of you, Australia and China, are friends. And to us, there is no value in us siding with either one of you in terms of our strategic interests and our economic interests going forward. So I do endorse, you should, both should work together as far as the region is concerned. APEC provides that venue for that collaboration, economic collaboration and cooperation after COVID. And we look forward to continuing that relationship.
Thank you. Thanks. I'd like to now move to something that both of you have raised, and in particular you, Sir Charles, the importance of trade and investment in PNG coming from Australia. And I guess what's happened in the past few months has created a climate that perhaps is not as welcoming as perhaps it was before. So, for example, as you know, earlier this year, Prime Minister Marape announced that the extension to Porgera Mine would not be granted. And Barrick Gold, or Barrick New Guinea, the joint venture mine operator that's owned jointly by Canada's Barrick Gold Group and China's Zijin Mining Group, that have suspended production. They suspended production in April and placed the mine in care and maintenance status. And last month, it announced that it would lay off permanently more than 2,500 local mine workers as of the end of this month. Big stuff. On Monday, quite separately, the Australian listed energy producer Oil Search announced that it would wipe as much as $570 million Australian dollars off the value of its assets in PNG and could abandon some drilling projects. And this is in light of expectations that the coronavirus-affected oil price collapse may not be temporary. This is all bad news for PNG's economy, and in particular, it creates a climate that will make investors from Australia perhaps more reluctant. What is your view, Sir Charles, on this? What do you see as this presenting for Australian investors?
Well, it's a difficult position for Papua New Guinea to find itself in. The Prime Minister, in his statement, one of his views for underpinning this approach, this policy, is that it's a short-term pain for Papua New Guinea for a long-term gain. I have grave doubts about that because investor dollar can move around the world internationally, and it will not wait for Papua New Guinea in the long term. If its short-term policies are seen as anti-investment in Papua New Guinea. So I am very concerned also that this trend in government policy is setting a very dangerous precedent for PNG's investment destination climate for foreign investment, not only for Australia, but globally. Because these are global companies with major investments around the world, and they have a lot of say, both in financing, capital flows into developing countries and internationally. So I do share a lot of concern in the country as well by a lot of Papua New Guineans about this approach by this present government. And I'm sorry to say this, but I never thought Papua New Guinea would get to that stage. But it has happened, and the consequences may be regrettable going forward.
Is there anything that Australia can do to support PNG during this particularly difficult time?
Well, Australia has done a lot to support Papua New Guinea in these circumstances. For instance, the LNG project, I remember a delegation of ministers coming down to seek Exim Bank support the fund there for, as a letter of comfort for investors and financiers to get into the LNG project. Australia, under Labor government, then committed $500 million of that fund. We never accessed it in the end, but it was always in the background supporting this. But I am not sure with this approach that Australia would be contributing to making that letter of comfort for this policy. That's my honest assessment. I'm not sure what Australia would do, but I predict that two governments might have to have a bit of a chat in the end to make sure that the support to this kind of policy may that it rewards Papua New Guinea as a whole. Thank you.
Ian, you've got a private sector experience now post your diplomatic career. What's your take on what's happening at the moment?
Thanks, Anne-Marie. I should disclose that I'm, in addition to the things you mentioned, I'm also Vice President of the Australia PNG Business Council. But I'll just give you a first look perspective. The poor grid looks terribly messy, and if you view it through the eyes of investors in major companies that are themselves engaged in PNG, it just looks bad. The timing is poor. I sort of feel that advice received by government might have underestimated some of the challenges associated with transition to government ownership. I know we've got both a judicial process in PNG and there's the prospect of international arbitration. It has to be said that Barrick's most recent experience in similar arbitration was very positive for Barrick and very bad for the other country involved, which was Pakistan. But who knows how that will go? Circumstances are different. It is about the signal it sends to the broader investment community, and particularly now when companies are constrained in terms of their capital budgets, they have to make even harder decisions or even more ruthless decisions, if I can put it that way, about where they put their investments. They're pulling back, and where it's complicated and difficult, you know, it's unlikely to attract significant investment. So I think a lot more work is needed on the messaging. Ironically, it's companies that are not engaged in this particular issue at Porgera, other companies that proportionally are more exposed to PNG than Barrick is, who may be facing more difficulty in convincing their own investors in turn that their strategy of engaging with PNG is the right one and a positive one. Because from an investor point of view, if you're a big corporate investor, I don't know, in New York or Europe somewhere, you put together the sort of key things, you, without entirely understanding what's going on, you put together this sort of language about take back PNG, however it's meant, and I'm not trying to say one thing or another, but that's what's heard. You also hear about this decision and claims of lack of consultation in the process in relation to Porgera. And then you sort of see the struggles that for whatever reason, people have been going through in trying to bring off new projects, whether it's in oil and gas or in mining. And people are left with an impression. So it just puts an imperative back on PNG. Maybe Australia could help in some way, but I think it is for PNG as a sovereign country to be very clear in its own messaging and in terms of consistency between external message and practice at home.
Can I just add one point there, Anne-Marie, and that is it's all up to the government as far as managing its sovereign risk. Very critical in terms of investment. If you're looking for investment, they will look at your sovereign risk. And I think that those two incidents, or that incident, does not send out a message that PNG sovereign risk is good, a good bet.
And just very, very quickly, Anne-Marie, I mean, just to Charles's earlier point about that time back then in 2009 when Australia was working to support PNG as the PNG LNG project was coming on. I don't know if we're going to have time to talk about the aid relationship, but to the extent that the aid relationship is relevant and important for the future, we should be taking our inspiration from that time where the development relationship was focused on a part of the PNG economy, which was in itself wealth generating and which in itself laid out a future of economic independence for PNG. Focusing what support Australia gives in such sectors will be vital going forward.
Well, since you've raised the aid program, let's have a look at that before we move to questions from our audience. So Australia's aid program to PNG has taken a front seat in the relationship for a very long time, rightly or wrongly, the program itself this year is worth something like 512 million Australian dollars. And it represents the biggest aid program that Australia has anywhere. It focuses on governance, economic growth, and human development. And right now, of course, it's had to focus very heavily on COVID response and supporting Papua New Guinea in its COVID response. Looking to the future, I guess my first question is, given your points earlier, Sir Charles, about the need to focus more on trade than aid, or perhaps just focus entirely on trade rather than aid, should Australia continue to have an aid program to PNG? And if so, what should the focus be? Sir Charles, do you want to take off with that one?
Yeah, well, it's not going to happen dramatically. That's the point. It will happen over time to reduce Australia's aid and refocus on economic investment and trade issues. So that's the first point. The next point is the increasingly, I think Australia is starting to target its aid so it gets the best value for its dollar. And I think that's a good start for going forward. I think you've done a substantial amount of dissipating the value of your aid by trying to do everything in all the sectors. I think it's a good time to reevaluate and focus. I mean, the health sector is one area that Australia's aid has been very effective and very strong in all aspects, infrastructure and technical assistance programs, etc. So I think that's a good start. And your partnership, Papua New Guinea Australia Partnership for Health, Transition to Health, is the initial recent initiative, is a good one. That's one area of expertise, and it's worth about $200 million, I think, that you could continue in. But the other component of that $520 million you raised is most of it is on technical assistance. Actually, I think $300 million of that $520 million is on technical assistance program, which in the past has not been that effective. And I think there is a concern and realignment by Australia in that area. And I think they're starting to, you're starting to review that and realign some of that fund towards infrastructure. Infrastructure is another big area that, in terms of the response, so to speak, to China's infrastructure moves in Papua New Guinea and the Pacific, I think that also may bring some value to the dollar, $8 that you're spending. So I'll leave it at that. There is some serious consideration for realignment, and that should be included, I hope, in the discussions between the two countries.
Ian, as a former High Commissioner, what do you think about the future of Australia's aid program?
The reality is that the Australian aid program, yes, it's the biggest that Australia has. It's significant as a signal of support. But if you relate the figure to the overall size of the PNG economy these days, if you relate that figure to the size of the size of Australian investment, commercial investment in PNG, so at $17 billion. It's actually a relatively small contribution to the PNG economy. And we Australians tend to overemphasize it in terms of its importance in PNG, in my view. It's an important signal. I would not propose giving it up at all. But I do think, as I mentioned earlier, that it should be focused on those elements of the PNG economy which are wealth generating, and that it should be targeted towards PNG becoming genuinely economically independent. So stimulating and strengthening those components of the economy that will create wealth for PNG and for Papua New Guinea.
Thanks. We've reached the time where we'd like to invite the audience to put their questions forward to us. All you have to do is use the Q&A button on Zoom, and you can submit it there. We have a few questions that have already lined up. So I'm going to ask both of you to answer this question. I think you're both in a position to have good views on it. It's a question from Tim Murphy. And he'd like to know, how does Australia and PNG normalise trade and travel between the two countries? Now, this is clearly post-COVID, because right now it's impossible, but at least on the travel side. But as we know, in the past, there's been the visa issues between Australia and PNG. So how do we normalise going into the future, trade and travel. So, Charles, do you want to start with that one?
Yes. I think for the visa issues, APAC provided an excellent experience. We had a magnificent effort from our immigration agency. That a lot of the incoming delegates from other economies were very complimentary of the way, smooth way that they can apply for their visa on the internet and get into the country. But with the COVID restrictions, the example that's been currently experienced is the movement of our essential, your essential services staff, Australians coming into Papua New Guinea. They still have to go through 14-day quarantine service. And Papua New Guineans returning. There's been a big mobilization of effort between our foreign affairs protocol division and the immigration, our immigration from internationally and from Australia, Papua New Guineans returning. So there is a suggestion of a bubble for Australia and Pacific and Papua New Guinea. That needs to be discussed and how to manage that within a COVID pandemic environment. So I think rushing things, as we can see, is not a good idea while COVID is rampant internationally and within our region. So it has to be carefully managed. But yes, there should be some consideration to movement of essential people, business people, technical people in the two countries. The framework is here already that we can manage these things. So I think that is important.
Ian, do you have any views on this one?
Look, I think that the trading relationship and the business travel relationship has probably been less impacted than many people think by COVID. It is possible for Australian business people to travel in and out of PNG. The company that I'm associated with and the broader council has actually found the PNG authorities accessible, very practical in terms of its engagement with the business community. Take an example, the Newcrest's Chief Operating Officer for Papua New Guinea is currently at Lihir, having travelled up to PNG a couple of weeks ago. Yes, he spent 14 days at Airways Hotel in quarantine, but he's engaging. We have found both governments, to be honest, quite facilitative of the of ongoing business, including ensuring the continuation of that key operation of the Lihir mine. There's a lot of equipment personnel that has to come back and forth, has to be subject to proper protocol. Both governments have helped. as for normalising travel beyond this, look, I think Australia has to take as a first step dealing with its own internal state boundaries. We've got to get through all that first. I think a Pacific bubble is still some way away. I can imagine it reasonably readily with New Zealand over time. I think a reality that Papua New Guinea and other Pacific Island countries will have to face as we move into that phase is that governments like Australia will want some kind of good, solid evidentiary data about the extent to which COVID-19 remains an issue in those countries. And I think it has to be said that we're probably not at that stage yet with PNG. We don't have a good enough picture of what's going on. Clearly, the country is not beset by coronavirus, but hard data on where it is, what the status is, that's going to be needed before we move into some relaxation of travel, I suspect.
Right, thank you. So our next question comes from our old friend Sean Dorney, and he's asking about the redevelopment of the Manus Naval Base. Now, I'm not sure how much either of you know about this in terms of the latest developments, but just to recap for the sake of the audience, it's been one of the big Australia PNG agreements in recent years has been the joint US-Australia PNG deal to upgrade the Lomburon Naval Base. And there seems to be some pushback, though, particularly from the Manus governor, Charlie Benjamin. And he seems to have the support of PNG's foreign minister for a review. What does this mean for the bilateral relationship? And as Sean asked, what do we know of what stage the redevelopment is up to? So, Charles, I'm going to ask you first, because of both of you, you might have more of an inside view on this.
Well, I must admit, I don't. And Marie and Sean, good to hear from you. It's a difficult question because, this was couched in the framework of security and regional influence of China, I think, rather than anything of substantive Manus-based development for Manus people. It is emerging to be a controversial arrangement, so to speak, to say the least. So I'm not surprised that the governor of Manus and at the political level, it's starting to gain some attention and probably traction to review this. But it's not. I am not very much in the loop on this. So that's the only comment I can make. It is contentious in terms of what its intentions are. Thank you.
Ian, do you want to add anything?
I give a shout out to Sean. It's nice to hear from him. I'll reach out to you later, Sean. But I would say that, just express a view that to be talking about the redevelopment of that naval base is actually a more positive thing to be talking about than the predecessor arrangement, the asylum seeker processing arrangement, which I think, you know, proved to be a difficult issue overall in the relationship. The cause of redeveloping an important military base, to me, is an important one. I think that can be done in the spirit of the bilateral strategic relationship in a very positive way, in the same way that other activities in the Defence Cooperation Program are undertaken, like the patrol boat program.
Okay, thanks very much for that. We have now another question, quite a different one, from Peter Aitsey. And he'd like a view from both of you on the potential risk of movements of people as economic refugees from PNG if the economic downturn within the region is prolonged. Ian, do you want to start with this one?
We're hearing from all our friends today. Good to hear from Peter. I think this does require careful monitoring. I must say that the cooperation between both the immigration and customs agencies between Australia and Papua New Guinea has been outstanding over the years, and that the regular exchange of information is very positive. So I think we're well placed to work together in managing any pressures that arise there. I'm hesitant to think of this as something that is, you know, a looming, very serious problem. There's been a lot of talk over the years about the potential for economic refugees to come through PNG to Australia. It's proved to be much less than many have expected. It's not really a regular channel for refugees seeking access to Australia. And apart from some interesting historic associations by certain Papuan communities in Australia. I don't see a great flood of Papua New Guineans wanting to come to Australia either. I also think that the arrangements we have in normal times around the border between Australia and Papua New Guinea are world class and world leading. So I think we're in reasonable shape. The overall demand for asylum seeker places in Australia has declined considerably as a result of Australian policies. So I don't see this as a very big deal just now. Something to watch.
Right. So, Charles, there's a question for you from Jan Zomedic. He would like to know, or she, I'm sorry, I can't tell from the name of gender, do you see a need for financial aid in the PNG health sector? Jan mentions that they've been working for over 6 years in volunteer capacity in health in the Highlands and have experienced firsthand that many women and children do not have access to primary health care. So with that as background, do you see a need for financial aid in this?
Well, definitely. And thanks for that question, because COVID has highlighted the necessity for just dealing with primary health care space. And the sanitation issues. And we also thank the effort and work by the NGOs, the very important cogs in a wheel to Papua New Guinea's development as well as its health in the health sector. So thank you for your health efforts and support in this area for Papua New Guinea. Yes, funding by both governments. It's a necessity to continue to maintain that or improve particularly primary health care. Statistics have not augured well for Papua New Guinea maternal health, child health areas. The issues of tuberculosis and malaria continuing threats. So with the pandemic looming, it's incumbent on both governments to continue focusing resources in the health sector and developing and enhancing relationships with those who are out on the field, like NGOs and rural health workers of Papua New Guinea deserve a lot more attention, a lot more assistance and support. So, yes, I fully endorse your question and highlighting this funding and resourcing of primary healthcare, particularly.
Good. There's a few questions on the aid program. As I said before, it always seems to end up in the front seat, whether or not it should. So I have a question from Goody Kuhlman, who's asking if PNG has focus initiative areas where Australian aid can progress, and to what extent does PNG drive this? So Charles, do you want to start again, and then Ian, if you could come in, that'd be great.
Well, of course, Papua New Guinea should be the driver in development and setting its priorities and funding its priorities. That's very critical. Historically, with your budget support, and increasing, and then at times Australia's aid was funding 80% of our Papua New Guinea's priorities and 20% of the 80-20 dilemma. And how to adjust that to balancing 50-50 Papua New Guinea and Australia, and even increasing it to Papua New Guinea 80% bearing its cost of its development and its priorities is very critical. So, yes, historical area of trends in Papua New Guinea's efforts to fund its own priorities have been lacking. But now, with the revenues from the major resource projects, there should be effort to make sure that these benefits and wealth that we're getting from our resources should be focused on taking over the responsibility of our own priorities, rather than depending on Australia's aid to take on the burden of developing through our priorities, policy priorities, and then we use our own funding for whatever it is that we are using. So I am very, very hopeful that governments, successive governments of Papua New Guinea will continue to talk sovereignty of the nation and walk sovereignty by funding our sovereignty. National interest and national development.
Thanks, Sir Charles. Ian, do you have anything to add?
Yeah, look, I would just say that, of course, external assistance needs to support and reflect the key priorities identified by the sovereign government concerned. And I believe the Australian Aid Program does. And, you know, the PNG government's development plans have a very strong focus on health and education and a range of other areas. There is also an imperative on the Australian government as the provider of funds to, you know, see the disbursement of those funds in a way that it can feel confident that its own constituency, its own population, its own voters will support. So there can sometimes be at least the dialogue, if not tension, around those issues. Where it tends to come together, in my experience and probably Charles's too, is at the annual bilateral ministerial forum where these issues are talked through. I always felt, sort of looking back, that it was almost as we needed sort of something else that engaged our leaders a little bit more regularly on the design and shape and management of the aid program. There was a bit of a tendency for politicians to come together briefly for half a day once a year and then back into their own political contexts. It'd be nice to see some kind of instrument emerged perhaps from this negotiation over the strategic and economic partnership, which actually brings us together in a more deliberate way at the leadership level over the design of the aid.
Okay, we actually have another question on aid, but I'm going to skip that just for a moment. I'll come back to it if we have time. But there's a question on Bougainville, and as we know, the referendum last year showed a vast, vast majority of Bougainvillians on independence. And of course, there are the local elections in Bougainville coming up, I think, in August. Ian Prentice asked the question, how do you both see the challenges and potential outcomes as that election plays out, particularly given the referendum result?
Shall I go first, Charles? This is a really interesting issue. I mean, there are very different perspectives here. You know, Papua New Guinea is right to, you know, very, very much think about this as a national issue. Australia and its role is a matter of some debate and discussion in PNG. When I look at the terms of the Bougainville Peace Agreement, and Ian Prentice, of all people, knows all about that. In the end, it allowed for a referendum, which has taken place. And as we know, we've seen Bougainvillians vote with a significant majority for independence. But it also requires endorsement and ratification by the National Parliament of Papua New Guinea. As Australians, when we listen to that and think about that situation, we often will take a slightly black-letter sort of legal mindset to the situation. And assume that, you know, here's a serious problem, it's all going to explode at some point. I don't know. Papua New Guineans have a way of finding their way through these issues. And I was, you know, heavily involved with Bougainville during my own time as High Commissioner. And I must say, I did observe significant support for independence when people were asked. But I also observed a deep reluctance on the part of most to go back to the situation of the 1990s and the conflict there. So I'm very hopeful there's a real, there's a spirit which will see cooperation and a new way forward beyond the BPA. And that will emerge in dialogue over the next year or two.
So, Charles?
Ian, how are you, mate? You should know these issues more than any of us. You spend a lot of time in Bougainville. But there are certain basics that I think, as far as national government, I can't speak for them, but from my observation, need Bougainvillians to do, and that is set up a functioning public service if they want to be independent. The funding arrangements that have been in dispute needs to be sorted out by both levels of government. And there are some terms of the peace agreement that needs to be adhered to, and that is the arms, surrender of firearms that is in Bougainville, and also to ensure that the infrastructure for being an independent Bougainville needs to be in place. So these are issues that are not small. If you want to be independent in your currency, how do you deal with your current own currency and you're setting up your foreign relations area. So the national government, I think, while it may at this stage express some reluctance about Bougainvillians going the independent, it's a part of Papua New Guinea sovereignty, but Bougainvillians have voted on it. So it will respect, in the end, I suppose, the Bougainvillians' desire. We don't want to, as Ian mentioned, revert back to the 1990s days. So it is basically a challenge for both governments, Bougainville people and Papua New Guinea people, the rest of Papua New Guinea, to move forward to serious discussions and how to resolve this issue. Because that referendum outcome will be voted on in Parliament. I don't know what the situation is there at the moment. But yes, all these areas are critical areas to settle amicably this issue.
Well, I think that's a really important question to end on. Unfortunately, we won't have time for any more. I thank you all, though, for putting in your questions. And fortunately, we've been able to answer most of them, but I'm afraid some of them we can't. But it's been an incredibly interesting discussion. And I want to thank both of you for making it that interesting. Sir Charles, who's been with us from Port Moresby, and Ian Kemish, who's been joining us from Brisbane. Thank you both very, very much. Thanks again to our event sponsors, BSP and Coca-Cola Amatil. To let you all know, we'll have a recording of this event to share on our website very soon, and you can follow the Australia PNG Network on Twitter and Facebook for alerts about our upcoming events. I'm Anne-Marie O'Keefe. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Anne-Marie.
Thank you.
Goodbye.